Good morning. Welcome for Computer Graphics. Today we will hopefully finalize the step to go from 2D to 3D. On Monday I already started with explaining how we can project 3D objects to 2D images mimicking standard cameras. And we saw that the correct way to generate images like a camera does or like the human eye does is to take a point projection. So we have our 3D object, we have a camera positioned somewhere in space, and then we generate rays in some sense from the object points to the eye, and where these rays intersect an image plane, this is the position where we draw our image point. Yeah, so it's a point projection. And the shape that contains all points that are projected onto a particular image is called the view frustum. And yeah, all points within that view frustum are then projected into our image. And this generates these perspective drawings or perspective images that we know. Distant objects get smaller in the image. And all these effects, parallel lines don't remain parallel. And we also learned that this is a new, larger class of transformations, which we call projective transformations. And the nice thing now is that we can describe this mapping using our framework with homogeneous coordinates. And here we derived that this perspective, if we have a very special setup or a simplified setup where we already transformed the scene such that it's in the origin, or that the camera is in the origin, and that we look, if we look along the z-axis, then this perspective projection simply means dividing x and y coordinates by z, and we can do that division with homogeneous coordinates. If we generate a matrix like this one, that looks very simple. And the important thing is that bottom line, because that makes that after, if we take homogeneous coordinates and we apply that matrix, the set goes to the homogeneous coordinate, and by dehomogenization, we divide by this set, and this gives us exactly this perspective division, this division that we want. So we can, if we have homogeneous coordinates, we can describe this perspective mapping with that very simple matrix. And this brought us to how now in general we define our matrices. And usually, just to make things easier to understand or to handle it better, we separate it into two steps, viewing and projection. And the first one, viewing, is just a rigid transformation, and it somehow positions the camera in our scene and says in which direction are we looking into. So that's just a rigid transformation, translation and rotation. And after that, we are in this setup. Now we are looking along the z-axis. And I told you that because usually we use a right-handed coordinate system, we usually change the setup so that we look along the negative z-axis. In that setup now, we do the perspective projection. And to this end, now we can even still use orthogonal projection. This is shown here. Now we are after viewing, we are in that setup, we look along the negative z-axis, and now x and y span the image plane, and now doing an orthogonal projection is extremely simple, because now we can simply take the x and the y coordinate of our point, and consider these as image coordinates. Now, parallel projection just means projecting parallel to the z-axis, so that just means throwing away z. Then we get a 2D image. In fact, we don't throw away z because we will need it for occlusion later on. And the alternative is to do that perspective projection, like here. And now this is a little bit more complicated, but in fact, it's exactly the matrix that we've seen before. It's just that the bottom row is a little bit simpler, and then we get this perspective projection here. So just by very taking two different, very simple matrices, we can generate both of these projections. So this is the one, the matrix for the orthogonal projection. Yeah, so in fact, it's the identity matrix. Yeah, couldn't be simpler. And for perspective projection, we take this matrix, and now in fact you see that this minus one here is different from the matrix we've seen before. And the reason is, if we take that matrix, then the set component, the depth, gets lost. Because all these points, all generated points, lie on the plane set equals one. Yeah, so it's a real projection. Yeah, so objects in 3D space are flattened on the image plane. Depth gets lost. And to maintain it, yeah, we set this value to one, and as a result, the after projection, yeah, the set value is this value here. Set is the value before projection, and after projection we have 1 minus 1 over set. And this is now a little bit weird, maybe at first sight. Yeah. So that means after this projection we still have a depth value, but it's not linear related to depth. But at least this function here, we will see it in a minute, yeah, is still in the range that is relevant, is still monotonically increasing. Yeah, so that means the order is not changed. So we can still use it for depth and to make occlusion and depth comparisons. So for that one, it will work, but it's not linear. Okay, and yeah, to look at the a little bit more closely, yeah. So up to now we said perspective projection means we take an object and we make a point projection towards the origin, and then we get this image here. Yeah, but this one, yeah, throws away depth, and now we took that trick that we also added this one, so we still have a depth value. And as a result, if you look at that a little bit more closely, what we realize is that this mapping now takes this view frustum here, which is infinite in this direction. Yeah, it's infinitely large. And if we look at that view frustum and look at how these points are mapped, we find out that this entire view frustum now by this transformation is mapped to the unit cube. Yeah, so this transformation takes this infinite view frustum and maps it to a finite cube. Yeah, and I spoke about that quite often. Yeah, projective mappings can map points from infinity to finite points. So these points here on the backside, yeah, end up at a final depth, yeah, at set equals one. And this also comes out if you look at that here. Yeah, if you set in set equals infinity, 1 over infinity is 0, 1 minus 1 over infinity is 1. Yeah, so points at infinity are mapped to finite points. Yeah, so that's rather convenient, yeah, because now we have depth values also from the unit cube, in fact, between also minus 1 and 1. So our transformation takes this view frustum and maps it to the unit cube. Yeah, and we can take x and y as the image coordinates, and set is a depth value. Yeah, and as it's still monotonically increasing, we can use it for comparisons. Okay, so that's nice. Yeah, so everything is very nicely integrated now in our matrices. There are a few technical things now that we still have to consider. Up to now we only projected onto this plane, but what we still have to decide is on the image plane, in particular here, which part or which rectangular window of the image plane is our final image. Yeah, so we still have to decide which part of that plane, which part we select as our image. And this can rather easily be done. We define a box using x min, x max, and y min and y max, and we say that this is the window that we want to depict in our final image. And for orthogonal projections, we can do exactly the same. Yeah, we also define this window x min x max. And yeah, that's a very simple affine mapping that we take this window and map it to the range from minus one to one so that we have our uniform, our unit window or unit coordinates between minus one and one again. Yeah, so that's rather simple. And normally, this is symmetric in the sense that x min is minus x max and y min is minus y max, but it doesn't have to be. Yeah, so there are special cases where this is not the case, but in probably 99% of the cases, it's symmetric. Okay, and this is the matrix, yeah, that we use to crop this window, and yeah, this is a matrix that then we usually apply after this matrix here, yeah, that does the projection. And after the projection, we crop the corresponding window. Okay, another thing that we have to consider is the following. So I said here, here in this image, yeah, what we see is that points at infinity are mapped to 1, but the question is also which points are mapped to set equals 0 or to set equals minus 1 if we have normalized values between minus 1 and 1. Yeah, this gives us a kind of the minimum possible depth value. And in fact, this is also a free parameter. This is also something that we have to usually have to define when we define our camera. We kind of have to say, what is the closest possible value or the smallest depth that an object should have? This is called the near plane. Yeah, so we will have to define a near plane, and objects on this near plane are mapped to the minimal possible depth value. Usually that's minus one, yeah, because we always have values between minus one and one. And to do all that correctly, we do something which is called depth normalization. And this means after this perspective transformation, we want to have depth values between minus one and one. Yeah. And to achieve that, we define two planes, in fact, even a near plane and also a far plane. And these planes now define our view frustum in the sense that we say, okay, this is our view frustum, and we always here have set our image plane. Yeah, now we say this is the near plane. And then we also define a far plane. And so if this is set, then objects on the near plane are mapped to minus one, and objects on the far plane are mapped to plus one. Yeah, so this entire thing is squeezed into the unit cube, which goes from minus one to one. Yeah, and this side is mapped to that one, and this is mapped to that here in the end. And yeah, now we sort of have to adapt our matrix so that really near is mapped to minus one and far to plus one. Yeah. And as we will see, far can become infinity. Yeah. So our matrix is still defined if we insert infinity for far. And then we are back at the solution that we've seen before. But for the general case, what we do is that we see in this matrix, we essentially are free how to choose these two values, A and B. These are the values that determine the final value or the mapping of set before to after. And now we want to select or have to select A and B such that set equals N, and because we look along the negative set axis, minus N should be mapped to minus 1, and minus far should be mapped to 1. And we can, yeah, solve these values and solve for A and B, and the resulting and the resulting matrix now looks like this. Here you can see the corresponding values that should be inserted here. It should be on the slides two before. It's somehow missing. Yeah, but we can solve for that. I mean, it doesn't matter how the exact formulas look like. You look it up anyhow. Yeah, but to understand the idea is important. So that means if we define our projective mapping, yeah, we have to define a near and a far plane. And these control how set is mapped. Good. Now, bringing all this stuff together, we will end up in a few standard matrices that will be used all over. Yeah. And these matrices will also be used in, or are also used in OpenGL and in all libraries. Yeah. You will see these matrices always coming up. And summarizing all that stuff. Now we have, we already spoke about the matrices for viewing. Yeah, this is positioning the camera, gaze direction, up vector. You remember, yeah, how we define these formulas. And now for projection, we usually or typically two different types of matrices are used. One type of matrix for orthogonal projections. And this matrix in general now looks like that. So, in fact, this cropping, choosing the window and choosing the depth range is unified in a way that we say we define our view frustum, which for orthogonal projection is a box. And we simply define it that we say, okay, we define the lower left closest corner of this box and the right top furthest corner of this box. Yeah, so we define the range in X, left to right, in Y, bottom to top, and in Z, near to far. Yeah, these six values define this box, and now we use this matrix which maps this box to the unit cube. Yeah, so this unifies the depth normalization and the cropping. Yeah, all this together generates this matrix. Yeah, and by this we can define any orthogonal projection. Any parallel perspective can be described with such a box here. And for perspective, yeah, we take the matrix that we've seen before, yeah, the very simple one, but now we also apply this cropping and the depth normalization. And for the cropping, yeah, we define that window on the near plane with left and right and top and bottom. And we define the near plane itself has a set value of N and the far plane has a set value of F. And with these values, left, right, bottom, top, near, far, yeah, if we multiply all this together, we end up in this matrix here. Yeah. So this is just the multiplication of depth normalization, cropping, and the projection. If we multiply all that together, we end up in this here. Yeah, and this now defines an arbitrary perspective. Okay, and now this is not too intuitive. In particular, this left, right, top, and bottom, yeah, is something, if you ask a photographer, yeah, what top value do you normally use? Yeah, he won't be able to tell you, because what a photographer usually uses to sort of define how the camera projects images, probably the most important value is the focal length of the object. Is it a wide angle lens or is it a tele lens? And in fact, we can derive that from this image. Because if we say we have a tele lens, let's say we have a camera, yeah, then, or let's put it the other way around, a wide angle lens means that the generated image or the view frustum, everything that is visible in that image, yeah, comes from a wide angle. Yeah, you see a wide angle of our world. Yeah, so let's say there's a house here. You can see the entire house. So in our context here, if we say this is the near plane, this means top and bottom are relatively large. Yeah, so this is B, this is T. Yeah, so these distances are relatively large values. If we say near is 1, yeah, then T might also be something like plus 1 and B minus 1. In that case, that would be 45 degrees. Yeah, so altogether we have an opening angle of 90 degrees, which is already pretty much. Yeah, this is a wide angle lens. A tele lens, yeah, now you look into a window here in this house, yeah, you take a very strong tele lens. What that means is that you have a very small field of view. Yeah? And now here top and bottom are rather small values, maybe 0.1 and minus 0.1. Yeah? So with top and bottom, yeah, and because they usually are symmetric, yeah, you choose one. With top and bottom, you can select whether you have a wide angle lens or a tele lens. And a more intuitive way to measure that opening angle, yeah, is the opening angle. Yeah? To say, we take now this angle here, yeah, and use this to define our matrix. And this angle is usually called the field of view. And for some reasons in computer graphics, this field of view is typically measured in y direction. Yeah. So that example here would be a field of view of 90 degrees. And for the tele lens, the field of view would probably be something like 10 degrees only here. Yeah. And with simple tangents or with simple trigonometric functions, we can compute these. Yeah? If we say our field of view, this is our field of view, then this angle is half of the field of view. And this value here, yeah, top, would then be the tangents of this half field of view, and bottom times the near plane. Near times, and bottom is just minus t. Yeah? So that's a very simple or much more intuitive way to say, okay, now I take a lens, yeah, that has an opening angle of 60 degrees. Yeah? That's something that is quickly understandable what that means. Yeah? And from these values, we can derive b and t from this formula here. And now you may ask, okay, top and bottom, but what about left to right? And yeah, in fact, left and right, of course, are very closely related, but there comes another thing now, and this is the aspect ratio of our image. If we have a square image, yeah, then left and bottom should be the same. Yeah, and top and right, at least the absolute value should be the same, yeah, because we generate a square image. But if our image is not square, yeah, then we have to adapt left and right accordingly. And we do that by defining the aspect ratio. That's just the ratio width over height. And multiplying left and bottom, left and right with this aspect ratio, yeah, so that we get an image that is not squeezed in some direction, but that really looks natural and that keeps that aspect ratio of the final image. And if we put all that together, we end up in this matrix or in this description. Our camera or our projection is just defined by this field of view. That's the opening angle. Yeah, that's this angle here. So in that example, we would have a rather strong tele lens. So we define the field of view. We define the aspect ratio. Yeah, that's how the image, yeah, the ratio of width and height of our image in the end, because after projection, there's always left is minus 1 and right is 1 and bottom is minus 1 and this here is 1. Yeah, so we sort of have to unsqueeze, yeah, to get an undistorted image. That's the aspect ratio. and with these formulas here, so these formulas we see here, n times tangents of half of the field of view in y direction, this gives us top and bottom, and the same value times the aspect ratio gives us left and right. Yeah, and this is a simpler way now to define a camera. Field of view, aspect ratio, and near and far plane. Near and far we still need to get the mapping offset. Yeah, and all this together, oh, also that matrix is missing, sorry for that. Now we can, if we replace right and left and so forth, we also get a formula for this matrix here. That's the typical way how this perspective matrix is described. Yeah, and a large field of view corresponds to a wide-angle lens and a small field of view to a tele lens. Okay, yeah, so as a result, yeah, now we have two matrices. Yeah, the perspective matrix takes such a view frustum here, defined by opening angle, aspect ratio, near and far. And this view frustum by this matrix is mapped to the unit cube. Or if we take an orthogonal projection, this box here is defined by left, right, bottom, top, near, far. And the corresponding matrix also maps it to the unit cube. And from here on, yeah, now we have in x and y image coordinates and in set depth values. That means if we have a 3D object, yeah, we take its 3D coordinates, first apply the viewing matrix, and then apply this projection matrix, and after that, yeah, we have the same object in this unit cube here. And we can directly take x and y as image coordinates, and we will also see that today, how we can use the set then to compute occlusion. Okay, and now we can look at this in a little demo. Okay, so what do we see here? We have again a cube object, yeah. And what you see here is a coordinate axis. I will rotate the entire view a little bit, yeah, so you can see the axis. And I can rotate my object arbitrarily, yeah, and I get a perspective image. Okay, so what do we see here on the right? On the right, we see the same cube. Yeah, it's now kind of a third person view. And the black thing is the current view frustum. Yeah, so you see the cube in the middle. I will look a little bit from the side. Maybe that's more intuitive. And if I move the camera here now, you see how the view frustum rotates around the object. Yeah. So, this is the view frustum, yeah, defined with a near and a far plane. And, here we see how we rotate around. Okay, now we can not only change, so here we essentially change the viewing matrix. Yeah, so we change the position of the camera. We rotate the camera around our object and always look towards the origin. Yeah, so this is, if we make one complete rotation, you see that we rotate once around the object. Yeah, and roughly this is roughly this perspective under which we are looking at the object. Yeah, so you see the coordinate system is aligned. Okay, now we can also change the projection matrix. Here we can change the field of view. Now we have a wide angle view. Yeah, so you see the object automatically becomes smaller, yeah, because we see more. So single objects become smaller. But we can also more generate a tele lens. Yeah, and here you see now we have a much smaller and thinner view frustum. Oops. Yeah, and can zoom in. Yeah, okay, that's not very helpful. Let's go back to something like this. Or we can change the near and far plane. Yeah, so here you can see that we can change near and far, and you can also see something interesting. If the far plane gets too close, then objects are cut off. That really means only objects that after projection are in the unit cube are cut off. Yeah, and that means that the far plane, yeah, really objects are clipped at the far plane. They are cut off. So the far plane definitely should be chosen far away. Yeah, and even if we look at the matrices, we see that we can use infinity for the far value and still get something reasonable. The near plane is more complicated. Also, the near plane, if we choose it too, we cannot see it here very well, Now, if we choose the far plane too big, yeah, then also objects are cut off. Yeah, everything that is in front of the near plane is also cut off. This is a strange effect. Yeah, no real camera, of course, has that. Yeah, that's mainly an artifact, yeah, of the way these things are computed and the convention that we only have after projection set values between -1 and 1. And everything before and after is cut off. Yeah, so we have to choose near and far wisely. Okay, now let me choose something reasonable. Okay, like this here. Now we can also make another, hopefully interesting observation. And that's this here. What we see here is now something a little bit weird. This is the same scene after the projective mapping. Yeah, after this perspective mapping. So now to the setup on the left, yeah, we applied this perspective matrix or all these matrices. So what you see here compared to world space, in world space, yeah, you know our view frustum is this pyramid shown in black. After this, yeah, this pyramid becomes the unit cube. Yeah. So this is now the scene after it has been squeezed from here to the unit cube. Yeah. And so the frustum now is the unit cube. And the cube inside here, so this object, yeah, now is deformed. It's something like this here, yeah. And this is the, probably you cannot see it. Maybe you can see it now better. This is the shape here on the right. And you see it's obviously no longer a cube, yeah. It's somehow weirdly squeezed. But it's squeezed such that if we look from here, yeah, it's now a perspective image. Yeah, this is now the negative z direction. So after this mapping, yeah, in here we see a perspective view of that original image. Yeah, that's how this entire thing works. And objects in the back are shrunk and objects in the front are enlarged. And if we look at it from the side, yeah, you can see this effect. We can even rotate. Can even rotate things now. Yeah, and you see always objects in the back become smaller, yeah, and those in the front become bigger. And if we look from this direction, yeah, we just see a perspective image. Okay. Good. So, this is the concept, essentially, yeah. And you see things are very nicely unified and we are very flexible and can generate everything we want. And you may also, I could also show that once again, because now there's one more interesting thing. And this is the following. Probably you've seen that here, I first selected a near plane, which is rather far away. Yeah, so it almost intersects the cube here. And in fact, if we say, okay, we don't want this, don't want to have problems with a near plane, so let's set it to a rather small value. Yeah, to 10 centimeters or 1 centimeter. I mean, we don't care. Yeah, we just don't want things to be cut off. Now, if we do so, and we look, if we look at the object after this perspective, we still get a correct image, but if we look from the side, what we see is that the object in depth is very much squeezed now. And this is an effect of this non-linear mapping of depth. And in fact, yeah, if here I choose, well, I still don't understand my own interface, okay, here, if I change the near value, you see that now slowly it unfolds, yeah? But if we have a small value, or if we put the near plane too close, yeah, all the depth values are in the far range, yeah. How can we explain that? We will have to explain that. Period. Yeah, in a minute. So here again, just a visualization of what we've just also seen here in the demo. Yeah, this is again now a visualization of our view frustum. We have a cube in here, and if we apply that mapping, we get something like this. Yeah, and now we can say all these rays here, yeah, that show the projection for the perspective mapping here now become parallel rays. And if we look from that side, yeah, this deformed object looks like a perspective image of that original object. And this is exactly what generates perspective. If we have a scene like this here with three trees, for instance, after this mapping, they look like this. So you see the first tree, the closest tree, becomes large. And the further the trees are away, the smaller they become. And if we look at that from here, yeah, then we get this image here. Yeah, with a large tree in the front and a smaller tree in the back. Yeah, just because of this squeezing. And there's also another maybe interesting effect, or how we can maybe describe that. And this is if we look at the mapping of the origin. Yeah, this is our camera center. And you see all the projection rays here come together in the projection center. Yeah, that's how we defined it. But if we do that mapping, this point is moved to infinity. So all these lines now become parallel lines, yeah, that intersect again at the image of that point, but the image of that point is at infinity. So the lines now intersect at infinity, yeah, which is, so that means they are parallel. Yeah, and so instead of now here, instead of projecting along these lines towards the point, now here we have a simple parallel projection that simply means, yeah, it's exactly the same like the orthogonal. Yeah, just take x and y as image coordinates. It's a parallel projection then. Yeah, so instead of doing a perspective point projection, we deform our object such that a parallel projection generates the right image. Yeah, that's also an alternative interpretation. Okay, and now if we look back to projective transformations, yeah, again, we can also here see here, parallel lines don't remain parallel. We know that from the railroad example, for instance. Ratios are not preserved. Yeah, so if we take a line and look at it perspectively, then the midpoint between these two points will not be the midpoint in the image. Yeah, so if in 3D this is the midpoint, in 2D it doesn't, it won't in general be at the middle, yeah, but moved more to the back. That's also a perspective effect of these mappings. Okay, and now let's look at the depth values. Yeah, I've already introduced or motivated what's happening here. Yeah, if we look at how depth values are mapped. So in the simple example of the introduction, this mapping was set to 1 minus 1 over z. And now if we also take depth normalization, we get these values or this formula here. Yeah, so this is A and this is B in this one particular matrix. Yeah, F and N are the near and the far plane. And if we choose the values like this, then the far plane is mapped to +1 and the near plane is mapped to -1. This is exactly what we wanted. And if we now show a grid here, now we generated a grid on the view frustum. Yeah, and here in depth direction, we have uniform grid distance. And after the mapping, we realize that the near part, I'm sorry that, so it's always here near is on the right and here it's on the left. Yeah, so these regions here are here mapped to a much larger region in Z. Yeah, and everything towards the far plane, yeah, is squeezed here at the end. Yeah, and this is what we've seen. Yeah, if we choose the near plane too close, yeah, then after this projection, everything was squeezed in the end or near Z equals 1. And yeah, this is these images. Yeah, so that means if we have a reasonable near value, yeah, then after this transformation, our object looks like this. But if we take a very small near value, then it's things become more and more dense here in the back. And in fact, if we only have a finite precision for Z values, yeah, then things can become so close here that we cannot differentiate depth anymore. That point is pretty quickly reached. Yeah. So don't choose n to, or don't set n to 1 millimeter or something like that, just to say I want to avoid problems. In fact, you generate problems by that. Yeah. Set it to something reasonable, 0.5 meter, 10 centimeters, something like that. Yeah. And then with depth, there won't be any precision problems. It's just an interesting effect. And here we can also maybe see the reason for the squeezing in another graph, because this formula here, you see, here Z is in the denominator. So if we have small Z, yeah, then obviously the corresponding value here becomes very large. So that's why if we have a small set here, yeah, the curve that maps the set before to the set after, yeah, is here highly nonlinear. And for larger values, yeah, it's almost constant, and for smaller values, it's very quickly increasing. This is an artifact of this mapping. And I mean, in practice, often it's not relevant, but it's probably good to at least know it, yeah, and to be aware of that. Okay, good. So now let's try sort of a little bit to summarize all that stuff and to also see how we really use it in practice. So I told you that you normally we say, okay, we have objects that are defined in world space. Yes, that's a kind of global coordinate system with X, Y, and Z coordinates, 3D coordinates. And now, first of all, we apply our viewing matrix. Yeah, so we rotate our scene and translate it so that the camera is in the origin. Okay? And we do this with a matrix. We've learned how that matrix looks like. And afterwards, we say we get new coordinates, and they are in the so-called camera space. Yeah, that's a space that is relative to the camera. Yeah, so first of all, we transform everything from a global world space to a local space of our camera. So everything now is positioned relative to our camera. Then we apply our matrices, our projection matrices, which are also called normalization. And after that, we are now in this weird space here on the right, yeah, where objects are deformed, yeah, but in this space we can directly use X and Y as image coordinates and Z as depth, yeah, and this space is called the canonical view volume, yeah, it's view volume and canonical because it's unit, yeah, everything is from -1 to 1. Okay, after that, still some transformation is happening, which is called viewport. Probably you can't read it, but it doesn't really matter because we don't care. This is now just a transformation that maps these unit coordinates between -1 and 1 to pixel coordinates. Yeah. So before the rasterizer can rasterize, it really needs pixel coordinates. Yeah. But we don't care about that. So all these matrices, they are completely independent of what is the resolution of our image and so forth. Yeah. It just ignores that part. And you also saw in the pixel shader, in the vertex shader, we didn't care about that. That's all done by later units or by the rasterizer. Yeah. So we don't care about that part. But in fact, on the other side, we still have one matrix. And this is the so-called model matrix. And you see the model matrix becomes before the world space. And in fact, the idea of the model matrix is the following. Usually, if we model objects, we don't really model them in world space, but we model them in their own local space. That means, yeah, let's say I want to model this object here. Yeah, then I open a 3D modeling tool and then I model it in its own space. Probably the origin will be in the center, and then I open a box, yeah, and I decide whether I use centimeters as units or meters or inches or millimeters or whatsoever. And then I have this 3D model living in its own space. Yeah. And then I position that object in my scene. Yeah. I say, okay, now this object should be under this rotation. You remember 3D rotations? At this position, under this rotation, the object is now in my 3D space. Yeah, and this can be described again by a matrix. And this is called the so-called model matrix. And this matrix, yeah, transforms an object from its own local space to the world. Yeah, it positions an object in a world. And from there, we apply the viewing matrix, then we are local to camera. And then we do the normalization, and this is the space in which we can continue with rasterization. And all these three matrices, model, viewing, and normalization, or projection, yeah, they can all be multiplied together. It's all 4x4 matrices. Yeah. So in the end, we will have a matrix for that particular object that for every surface point directly maps it to image space. Yeah. And can multiply all that together. And this is often referred to also as a pipeline. Yeah, this pipeline or the entire rendering process will become an even longer pipeline. And at the beginning in this pipeline, yeah, we can say, okay, we take coordinates of our object and then first apply the model transformation, then the viewing transformation, the normalization, and then even the viewport transformation. Yeah. So from a mental model, we can say these are single steps, but we can multiply all these matrices together to make it more performant. Yeah. But our pipeline model somehow has here 4 different steps, and each of these matrices are special transformations. Yeah. So the modeling typically is a similarity transformation. Viewing is even richer. This one is projective, and viewport is then affine or even a similarity. Okay, good. So, yeah, putting it all together, So these are the different matrices, the viewing matrix, So first of all, we model, and then viewing and transformation, I already said so, are usually describe the position of our camera and how the camera works. And an alternative way to describe that is what is in computer vision, for instance. People also work a lot with cameras, and there they differentiate between the extrinsic parameters of a camera and the intrinsic parameters. The extrinsic parameters are where you position your camera and where you're looking at. So that's exactly the viewing parameters. And the intrinsic parameters are what you change in the camera, yeah, with knobs at the camera or by rotating the lens and so on. And these are intrinsic parameters. And this is the field of view. the aspect, yeah, and near and far, a real camera doesn't have, but these are typically called intrinsic parameters. Yeah, they are internal to the camera, and that's the projection. Yeah, and to describe now a camera in our space, yeah, we have to define the extrinsic and intrinsic parameters, and here they are summed up. So we have to define a position of the camera, a view direction. This view direction is typically not defined as a direction, but by defining a look at point, that's a point the camera is looking at. Often that's more intuitive than a direction. Then we define our up vector. Yeah, what in the world is up? Then we define our field of view. That's the first intrinsic parameter. What's the aspect ratio and the near and the far plane? And with these parameters, yeah, we can build up the viewing and the projection matrix with the matrices that we've seen before. And in fact, if we use WebGL, or at least old OpenGL, there was directly part of the library or of OpenGL were methods that directly generate these standard matrices. So for instance, code for GL ortho that generates this orthogonal matrix, GL frustum generates this perspective matrix, or the simplification using a field of view, that's what was called GLU perspective. Yeah. And for viewing, there was a method GLU look at. Yeah, this defines this defines the projection matrix. This defines the view matrix, camera, look at point, up direction. And the modeling transformations were computed using methods like GL translate, rotate, and so forth. Yeah, so that was possible to concatenate these matrices to get a model matrix. And they were built-in matrices, yeah, and automatically vertex coordinates were sent through these matrices automatically. And the matrices were, for some reason, not directly multiplied all together to a model view projection matrix, but two separate matrices were kept. A model view, that's the multiplication of view times model matrix, and a separate projection matrix. Yeah, so this was performance-wise not perfect, but yeah, the designers of the API said it makes sense to be able to change the projection matrix separately. Okay, we can always discuss whether this makes sense. I only say so because these names are still used all the time. Modern OpenGL and WebGL don't have these matrices anymore, yeah, which is a little bit unfortunate, maybe, yeah, because that was much easier. Yeah, today we have to do it the hard way and have to do all these computations by ourselves and generate matrices and then upload these matrices to OpenGL or to WebGL, and then WebGL just uses these matrices. Yeah, so WebGL doesn't directly give us a method like GLU perspective, yeah, that just sets the perspective matrix and we don't have to care anymore. Instead, we have to compute that matrix in our program and then upload the matrix as a uniform to the vertex shader, and the vertex shader can apply it. And of course, there are libraries available that do all these computations. Yeah, they are outside of WebGL. These are really separate libraries. There are several available, GL Matrix JS, Math JS, for instance, if you want to do it in JavaScript. Yeah, but yeah, it's not so nicely uniform as it was before. And in these libraries, it's exactly these methods that have been reprogrammed. Yeah, these libraries typically also have methods, ortho, frustum, perspective, look at, and so forth. Yeah, and yeah, you have to use them there in this context. Okay, and we can, I forgot to add a link because I also have a little demo on that. No, I've already shown that one, right? Okay, I've Did I already show that one with the matrices and how to apply that? Yes, I did. Okay, nobody disagrees. Yeah, so in this little demo, maybe, because it fits very nicely, here we can see that. Yeah, so that's the vertex shader that also does a projection. And you just see we have some matrix called M. This is supplied as a uniform. And then the vertex shader only takes the 3D position, makes it a 4D vector. So this is adding the homogeneous component and then multiplying with that matrix M. Yeah, and that matrix M is set by the main application. Yeah, and it contains now this matrix. So this is not the best example here because this was still a very simple one. But to compute that matrix, you have to imagine now we compute the model matrix, we compute the viewing matrix with look at, we compute the projection matrix, we multiply all these matrices together, and the resulting matrix then is uploaded as a uniform. And then OpenGL renders using that matrix, but where that matrix comes from, it doesn't care. Yeah, this matrix contains everything. Okay. Good. So, a lot about this projection stuff. If there are any questions, let me say that again. I'm always happy to answer your questions. So please, don't hesitate to raise your hands or whatsoever. We still have one problem left when we go from 3D to 2D. And luckily, this problem is much easier to solve and probably also to understand. Maybe not in half an hour, but I hope the main idea I can explain in the rest of the lecture today. And this is occlusion. Let's look at this very simple example. Here we have two triangles. Yeah, they are in 3D space. And we project them into our image. Yeah. And now when rasterizing, or when rendering or applying the scanline algorithm, depending on the order in which we rasterize, we either get this image or this image. Yeah. But for an observer, of course, it is clear this object is in front of this one, and here this triangle is in front of this one. But in fact, which one is in front only depends on the order in which we render rasterize them. So now, how can we generate the right one? If in the 3D world that triangle is in front, we should probably first rasterize that one and then that one. And if it's the other way around, we should do it like that. And in our set coordinates, we still have the information how close objects are. We explicitly kept this information. So how can we use that to create occlusion correctly? And the probably simplest way would be the following, that we just say, okay, we try to order the objects from back to front. That's the so-called painter's algorithm, because that's what a painter does. If you paint an image, you first draw the background and then draw closer and closer objects. So with closer objects, you overdraw your background. And in the end, you have the right order. If you do it the other way around, then you will get obviously a wrong result. Okay, so sorting is a very well understood problem. But if we consider that we have scenes with something like 10 million triangles, then we have to sort 10 million triangles to achieve the right result. And this can be done rather quickly today, but not too quickly. So it's probably not a very feasible way. And in fact, there are situations that cannot be solved by this algorithm. If you look like this here, so here one triangle penetrates the square here. Now here in that region, the square is in front of the triangle, and here the triangle is in front of the square. So how can we order it? There are also more subtle cases where this can happen. Yeah, here we have cyclic occlusion. Yeah, there's always one in front of the other. Yeah, and in the end, there's no chance to sort that somehow. Yeah, so that we get with Painter's algorithm the right result. And it's expensive anyhow. Yeah. Okay, so that's not really practical, but there's a very simple approach, and I think that's rather easy to understand. And that's the following. While we rasterize our objects, our triangles, or when we rasterize them, we have the following situation. We have that triangle. For each of the vertices, we know x and y. And these define the position in image space. Yeah, this is what we did when we learned the scanline algorithm. Yeah, we had x and y coordinates of the vertices, and then we enumerated the pixels. Yeah, okay. So, but now additionally, because this triangle comes from 3D, we also have a set value for each of these vertices. Yeah. This won't be the same. It's the set vertex of this triangle. And for points in between, we can also determine the depth. How? By interpolation. Yeah? Because we simply take the set value here from the three vertices and interpolate them with barycentric coordinates, like we did for Gouraud shading. And I told you that during rasterization, we do not only interpolate colors for Gouraud shading, but we also interpolate other things, for instance, set. Yeah? Okay. And does that work? Yes. One problem might be, I just 15 minutes ago, I spoke about that problem that the mapping of set values in world space to that in this space here, that this mapping is non-linear. Yeah, so you might say, okay, can we really interpolate these values? And the answer is yes, because projective mappings have the nice property that lines remain lines, and thus also planes remain planes, and thus triangles remain triangles. So a triangle in world space after this mapping is still a triangle. It's deformed, but it's still a triangle. Yeah. And so a linear interpolation with barycentric coordinates in that space delivers a valid result. Yeah. So we get correct depth values. Yeah. This would not work if we would map the set differently. Yeah. So some people might say, okay, if we have problems with this nonlinear mapping, yeah, why not just ignore for set this projective transformation and take the original set? Yeah, that might work, but then this interpolation would not work anymore, because then a triangle afterwards would look like this. Yeah, and then linear interpolation doesn't work anymore. Okay, so yeah, we have vertices. We rasterize them, and during rasterization, as we learned, we also interpolate set. So for every pixel now, we also have a set value. Yeah. So here we know set, here we know set. For each of these pixels, we know a set value. And what we do now is that we just compute this occlusion for every pixel separately. So for every pixel, we store the set value of the currently frontmost object that was visible in that pixel. Yeah. So for every pixel, we just say, okay, this is the current frontmost value or object that was visible in that pixel. And if we rasterize now and we get a new pixel with a particular set value, we just compare that set value with a stored set value. And if my new pixel is in front, yeah, we rasterize it and update the set value. And if it's behind, then we simply throw away that pixel. Yeah, then we discard it. It's not visible, it's occluded. Yeah. And this can be implemented very quickly or very easily. The buffer that for every pixel stores the current set value is called the set buffer, yeah, for obvious reasons. And now the set pixel method, yeah, is rather simple. The only difference is the following. So we set a pixel at position X and Y. We want to set it to a particular color, and in addition, we also have to provide its depth value depth. Yeah, that's the interpolated depth value. That's this set here. Yeah? And now, first of all, we compare the current value of the set buffer with this depth. And if the depth is smaller, yeah, that means we are closer to the camera than the currently frontmost object in this pixel is, then we set the color, we also set the depth, and we are done. Yeah, if we are behind, then we do nothing. And that, of course, can be, yeah, okay. Algorithmically, it's very simple. In practice, on a GPU, this part is rather complicated because we have so many parallel stages that do rasterization. And we have many stages that rasterize single triangles, and they can all write to the same pixels. So, in fact, this is the phase, or this is the part where synchronization has to happen, yeah? Which hardware-wise makes it complicated, but we are not doing hardware here, we're doing software here, and software-wise it's very simple. Okay, so how does that look like? Also for that, oops, I have a little demo. Okay, so what do we see here? Here we see a cube, yeah, for instance, and we can rotate that cube, and in contrast to the previous examples, I was only drawing always a wireframe model. And for a good reason, yeah, because for wireframe models, we don't have to care about occlusion. But now, yeah, we fill our faces, and now we need occlusion. Yeah, we need to consider that. And we need that set test, and you see, obviously, it generates the proper result, and we can turn the set test off. Yeah. And what we get now here is this weird thing. Yeah. This looks completely wrong, and what is in front just depends on in which order are the six faces of the cube drawn. So probably there are positions where we get the right image. Oh, it's obviously more difficult than. Okay, if you wish, you can search for it. Maybe there's one. Yeah, but it's obviously the result is wrong. Yeah, but if we turn the set test off, we get the right result. And here on the right, you can see the depth image. That's a direct visualization of this depth buffer. Yeah, black means far away. Black means unset, white means far away, and the darker it gets, the closer it is. In fact, it's surprising that this region is not white, by the way. Okay, I have to look that up where it comes from. Okay, but within the cube, I think it's clear what we see. So here it's darker because it's closer, yeah? And the more we go to the back, the brighter it becomes. And these back faces here, just for every pixel, have a larger depth value, so they don't survive this depth test. And so we always see the right face in front. And now we can make, again, maybe an interesting experiment and look at what happens if we change near and far. So if we change the near plane, of course, first, not much happened, but you see that on the right, the depth values change. Yeah, this is just because the interval that we map to -1, from -1 to 1, this interval becomes smaller in this case. Yeah, so we have a larger range of depth values in that example. And at some point, yeah, the near plane here now cuts off or cuts a hole into that cube. So obviously that's a bad choice for, for the near plane. And if we make it smaller, we get a proper result. We can try the same with a far plane, but in fact, the effect of the far plane is much smaller. That's just because of that behavior of offset, that the near plane has a much larger effect on this mapping than the far plane. So you can, in fact, you can choose the far plane as large as you wish. Even 1 million is fine. Even infinity is fine, yeah, because it converges. That doesn't change much, but the near plane is important. Okay, good. So, and of course, now the nice thing is this does not only work for cubes, yeah. It also works for other objects, like for instance bunnies, yeah. So here now we can see that this bunny, this object has holes here in the surface, but otherwise we get just the right result. If we turn on off the set test, we get this here. So obviously the order of the triangles is sometimes a little bit random. So yeah, here weird holes appear, and with a set test we get the right result. And again, also here the depth image, yeah, you see the head is closer, so it's darker, and the further away it is, the brighter, and so automatically all the right pixels then are discarded and not rendered. Okay. This we already spoke about, yeah, and now maybe just if you're looking for fun projects for the weekend, yeah, so with a set buffer you can make nice effects or can try nice things. And one thing for instance also is that we can do something which is called hidden line rendering. So often these wireframe drawings, or they also have advantages. Yeah, for technical drawings, people often use wireframe drawings because they better show the shape. And for technical constructions, yeah, you can often see more in wireframe renderings. If you have a complicated object, yeah, because we have no occlusion, then things become weird. But a compromise is something like this here. This is a wireframe rendering, but all occluded edges are discarded. Yeah, so it still looks like a technical drawing, but we have occlusion. And how can we achieve that? Yeah, I think you don't need to think about it very long, or I hope you don't need. So the idea here is that we simply first draw this entire object in white with filled faces. Yeah. So we rasterize this scene, but in white. That means, yeah, you draw white on white, nothing happens. But when we do that, the set buffer is also filled. Yeah, so after we rendered everything, our image is still white, but the set buffer contains the correct values for each pixels. And then we draw the lines on top. Yeah, and now all occluded lines will be discarded by the set buffer, and all lines that are on the surface will not be discarded because they have exactly the same depth like it is in the depth buffer from the first pass. But yeah, they will only in theory have exactly the same value. Yeah, because now I have the problem. I first render a face, and then exactly on top I render a line, and due to numerical precision, yeah, you know that comparing floating point values is probably not a good idea, yeah, because equal means roughly equal, yeah. And so how do we define this roughly equal? A very simple way is just when we render or when we rasterize these lines here, we just move them a little bit towards the camera, yeah. So we offset them a little bit so that they are definitely above the surface or in front of the surface, and nothing wrong is discarded. And this problem, yeah, that the C values, even if they are on the same surface, in practice won't be always, is called set buffer fighting. And this can This can be seen here in that example. So here we have our teapot. This is the rendering that we want to have. That's a variant. So here we have a real shading, or we have real colors in the background and want to see that triangle mesh on top, yeah, as black lines. And if we do that naively, or if we want to achieve something like this here, such a hidden line rendering, and if we do that naively, we will get that problem. Yeah, that's exactly that set fighting problem. So you see, from time to time, pixels are thrown away incorrectly, just due to that precision problem. And if we do that polygon offset, yeah, that we either we move the lines to the front, or when we rasterize the polygons, that we move them back a little bit, we get here a proper result. Okay, another nice trick is haloing. That's also a way to generate wireframe renderings that better allow us to perceive depth. And this is probably something, if you draw a cube on paper, yeah, you do something like this, and that's the following. If two edges cross, you intersect the line that is in the back. Yeah, so you see here this little gap. Yeah, and this makes it clear that this one is in front of that one. Yeah, here we can see it. This one is in front, and this one obviously is in back. Yeah, so that's a nice trick to visualize what is in front, what is in back. And how can we do that with a set buffer? Yeah, the idea is, again, the following. We make two passes. In the first pass, we render that cube with thick lines. Yeah, so we make lines thick, and we rasterize that these lines and only use it to fill the depth buffer. Yeah, so we rasterize them in white, or we even, that's also possible, turn off writings to the frame buffer, yeah, so that we only rasterize into the depth buffer. And then we draw on top, we draw the original thinner lines again, and now we get this gap here, because the depth buffer still knows this, still sees this thick version of that line, or has this stored. Yeah, and this thick line now generates an occlusion that leads in to this gap here. Yeah. Okay, that's just a little bit tricks, yeah, to see how we can exploit that set buffer for nice ideas. Or nice effects. Okay, then there's one more thing which we should speak about when we speak about visibility, and because it's a feature, yeah, that appears rather often, and it's closely related to visibility, and this is called backface culling. And the idea is the following. Normally, our triangles or our surfaces describe the surface of a solid object. Yeah, like the bunny you've seen before in original is whatever, clay or plaster. It's a solid object. Yeah, you cannot go to the inside. It's solid. And the triangles describe the surface of that solid object. Okay, so that means the following. Essentially, for every triangle, we can define which side of the triangle is inside and which side of the triangle is outside. Yeah? We can define that by defining a vector that is perpendicular and that always points to the outside. Yeah? We call that vector normal. Yeah? So for every triangle, we define a normal, and this normal, we say, yeah, because we have two perpendicular vectors to a triangle, but we say we always take the one that shows to the outside. Okay? And now if we rasterize a triangle, we can make a very first simple test whether this triangle can be visible or not. A triangle is only visible from a current point of view if our camera is at the side of the triangle in which the normal points to. Yeah, if we have, let's say, this is a cross-section of our bunny, yeah? This is a triangle, this is the corresponding normal. Now here's my camera, Yeah, obviously, or like this triangle I can see, but if my camera is here, I would look at that face from the back, but because the object is solid, yeah, I cannot see that triangle because there will be some other triangle in front, definitely. Yeah, because to see that triangle, I must get inside that object, and to get inside, I also have to pass a front-facing triangle. So with respect to this camera, yeah, we call this here front-facing. And this one here, back-facing. Yeah, and what is front-facing and what is back-facing depends on the camera. Huh? And a very simple way to speed up our rendering now is that for every camera, we simply discard all the back-facing triangles. Yeah, so roughly 50% of our triangles can simply be thrown away, yeah, or discarded from rasterization, because we know we cannot see them anyhow. The only possibility, in fact, to see them is that we go inside the object, but because it's solid, yeah, we can safely say, okay, that doesn't make sense. Yeah? Okay, and this idea is called backface culling. Yeah? It's mainly a simple way to speed up rasterization or rendering, yeah, by simply discarding 50% of the triangle, because we quickly can say they don't contribute to the image anyhow. Yeah, they, in the end, even if we rasterize them, unless we have such weird positions, they will be always occluded by a front face. Yeah. Okay, that doesn't mean that with backface culling we don't need a set buffer anymore. We will see that in a minute, but we can throw away many faces that won't contribute anyhow. Yeah. So here again, an example. We have this object here. Yeah. And these thick faces are those that are front facing. Yeah. This one is just is probably a border case. Yeah. But they are definitely front facing and these are back facing. So during rasterization, we rasterize these and quickly try to discard this one. Okay. Now, the disadvantage is that this means that for every face we need to know a normal, yeah, and that means for every face we have to store would have to store additional information, and in fact we can avoid that because there's a nice way, or a cleaner there's a nice way to encode that information, which is front and which is the front side and which is the back side of a triangle, using orientation. And here the idea is the following. If we define a triangle like this one here, A, B, and C, we have a degree of freedom in which order we enumerate the vertices. Yeah, if we have such an index buffer, yeah, we can say arbitrary orders of A, B, and C all describe the same triangle. Yeah, so if we have triangle 1, 2, 3 with vertices 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 3, 2, 3, 2, 1. Yeah, they are all the same triangle. Yeah, just the order is different. So we can use that information to encode what is front and what is back in the following way. We say that usually if we store a triangle, if we look at the triangle from the outside, yeah, that's the way how we normally see a triangle, then the vertices should also be ordered counterclockwise. Counterclockwise because it's the mathematical positive sense. Yeah. So if you have a coordinate system, yeah, the typical rotation is this way, which is counterclockwise. Yeah. With X and Z. Okay. So if we define triangles, yeah, we always enumerate the vertices counterclockwise. Yeah? Okay. And why is that interesting? Well, this order changes if we look at the object from the other side. If we look at the same triangle from the back side, yeah, in this example, then it will look like this. Now we look from the backside, you see A and B have changed, and now the order of the vertices is clockwise. Yeah? And that means we can do the following in our 3D world. Yeah, when we specify our triangles, we always enumerate store the vertices in a counterclockwise order. Yeah. Then we take these triangles, project them into our image, and the rasterizer, first of all, determines again the order of the vertices. And if they are still also in the image counterclockwise, then it rasterizes them. And if in the image their orientation has changed, yeah, then the rasterizer knows, oh, I see that one from the back and I can simply discard it. Yeah. And of course, this test of orientation shouldn't be too expensive. And in fact, it's not very expensive. So what we can do is that the typical way to define orientation is to use the cross product. Maybe you remember that if we compute the cross product of two vectors in 3D, then the direction can always be determined using the right-hand rule. Yeah, so you take the thumb as the first vector and the pointing finger as the second vector, and then the middle finger gives the direction of the cross product. And what we do now is that we take A, B, and C, yeah, and we say, okay, the edge from A to B is the thumb, the edge from A to C is the pointing finger, and then if the cross product, yeah, has a positive set value, then we have a positive orientation. And if it's like this, yeah, then the set has a negative value, the set component of the cross product, and then the orientation is different. Yeah, so we lift the 2D points to 3D again, compute that cross product and look at the set component. Yeah, so that's rather simple. It can be written down rather easily for arbitrary points A, B, and C, and then we can determine whether it's the orientation is positive or negative. We don't have to do that by ourselves, but OpenGL or WebGL directly supports that, because it's a really simple way to get rid of a lot of work, yeah, before rasterization. And so you see, we can simply enable the culling of faces, and we can even say whether it should cull front faces, we can even define what is a front face. In this example, a front face is where the vertices are counterclockwise. CCV stands for counterclockwise. That's the normal way. And we can say whether we want to cull front or back faces. There are algorithms that also make sense where it's interesting to cull the front faces and to see the back faces. But for now, we will use the very simple option just culling back faces, because they don't contribute to the image. And you see, we can turn that here on, and you see no difference. But if we would look at timings, yeah, or at the rasterizers, we would see that in this example, really only these three visible faces have been rendered, and those in the back have been thrown away. And we can maybe see that if we turn on front face culling. Yeah, now we do the stupid thing. Yeah, we cull these faces that are in front and only show the back ones, and this is the result. Yeah, now we can. It's always the faces facing the viewer are left out. Yeah, and so we always look inside, to the inside of the cube. And of course, as I said, yeah, backface culling somehow, or in this example, can even replace the set test, because now we have really only one face per pixel. The back faces we don't need the set buffer for, because they are culled anyhow. But of course, that only works for such simple objects. For the bunny, for instance, it will all already fail. So if you look at the ears, for instance, yeah, now we have multiple front faces behind each other, And now again, yeah, at least within the front faces, we need the set buffer to get the right result. Yeah. So in that case, between these two, we don't see a difference, but this one is faster. And so in this case, it's mostly about speeding up the computations or the renderings. Okay. So sorry, I needed 3 minutes too long. But yeah, we will see again next week on Monday, and then we will speak about lighting. How can we get light into our scenes? Thank you. See you then.